This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, why Russians have a healthy dislike for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Afro-Colombians have launched a general strike in the mostly black city that serves as the country's largest port. And, for the first time in a very long time, supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal think there may be a way to get him a new trial. But first, voters in the majority black city of Jackson, Mississippi, the state capital, go to the polls on June 6th to pick a new mayor. The frontrunner is Antar Lumumba, son of former Mayor Chakwe Lumumba, the radical black activist and lawyer who died during his first year in office in 2014. Kali Okuno is a key activist in Lumumba's campaign and a veteran of the Malcolm X grassroots movement. The Lumumba team has run and won in Jackson, and they've run and lost. But the current race doesn't feel like deja vu to Okuno.
There's definitely a level of maturity, more confidence that I think our team feels from having been through this before. But we've been through this in some respects two times now on the mayoral level. So that was Chokwe's campaign and closing that out in 2013. And then there was a special election with Chokwe Antar in 2014. And that got to a runoff between him and Mayor Tony Yarbrough. And we underestimated our enemies at that time around. And we wound up paying the cost for it because that was really, even then, was quite honestly, in my opinion, ours to lose. And by not really focusing in on turning out the base during that last kind of 2 weeks of the runoff and trying to win some other folks over, the mother folks let us have it. They turned out in record numbers for Tony Yarbrough, and that was really what pushed him over the edge, because even in that special election, we actually won the majority of black votes. And normally when you win the majority of black votes in Jackson, you should win confidently. And it didn't happen last time. And that was kind of an aberration of history. So while there's confidence on our end going into June 6th, I don't think we're going into this one blindly or half-stepping in the way I think we did a little bit before, at least got a little bit comfortable. So there's still a way for the reactionary forces in town secure a victory here. I want your listeners, I think, to understand that if the black voter turnout is low, then there are a couple of ways which a couple of communities, the white communities to the northeast part of the city, if they turn out strong like they did in 2014, there could be a much closer race than one might think. And one of the things we've been trying to counter is so many people here on the ground just thinking that he won the primary outright, so it's basically over. And in many respects, that's far from the truth. So this last week is critical around getting the message out. And to me, just as importantly, firming up certain commitments as to what are going to be the priorities of the incoming administration for like his first 100 days and beyond, given the many battles that we know we're going to confront. So setting the tone now, setting the agenda now is just as important, I think, as winning on the 6th. And so we are definitely at hard work, very hard right now, doing that in every spare moment that we have.
I believe you got 56% of the vote in the primary in an overwhelmingly black city. So when you describe the base, your base, all black people is not your base. Your base is,
no,
is a segment of an overwhelmingly black, but not all black folks.
That's right. That's right. I mean, to be specific, our calculation, we are dependent upon black working class votes, very dependent upon black working class votes. And if we can't turn black working class people out, then we typically are in trouble. And the way that the game is traditionally kind of run and orchestrated here, on average, you got between about 40 and 50,000 people at any kind of general election like this who turn out and vote in Jackson. And so that's usually a contest between folks who feel they got a continual stake in the game and normally folks who got a little bit of money and some education involved in some civic groups. and it does not necessarily mean the vast majority of the black working class in the city. So our hopes rely on moving people and getting them to the polls who don't normally turn out to the polls, who don't normally see themselves having a stake in the game. And we're going to have to do that again June 6th and try to get some of those folks who vote for the more traditional black petty bourgeois candidates that enter into the fray. We're going to try to have to win some of them over because we want to win this in an astounding manner. We're trying to secure 80% of the vote because we want to send a clear mandate to the governor and to our neo-Confederate Republican supermajority. There's a force that's going to have to be contended with here. So, you know, that's the core of our base. And when I say base, that's the bedrock foundation of it. But of course, you know, like in politics, or almost any politics, bourgeois politics, there are different alliances and accords that people have with different forces, and that exists here. People should not be under some illusion that it does not. There is an allied force that kind of makes up some of the backbone of what Chokwe did in 2013 and what Antar has been able to pull off in the here and now. But we don't resonate with the working class base. You know, all the rest of those alliances pretty much don't mean anything. So that's who we're trying to move, trying to appeal to. And when I was referring us kind of locking down what the agenda is, that's really a move to make sure that their interests are at the forefront, because it's in this period now from the primary to the general election where everybody, the contractors come in and the small business people come in and they try to do the horse trading and the tit for tat. I'll turn out my people. I'll turn out my church. You guarantee somebody here this position, or when this contract comes available, you'll consider me. You won't forget me. All that politics is being played, and we have been fighting very diligently as an internal block within the organization to say that that's not going to be the lead, cannot be the lead, and to the extent that it kind of rears its head, there's going to be a fight over it after June 6th is said and done.
Well, what is your grand plan, the large scheme that you have in mind?
Good question. I mean, the primary thing, I think, this next 4 years, unlike what happened with Chokwe 4 years ago, the initial forward position is more limited. Just so the audience knows, the conditions between 2013 and 2017 are profoundly different. When Chokwe came in, Chokwe Lumumba came in 2013, just to cite one issue, you know, you had a city which had a surplus budget that had some challenges and contradictions, no doubt, but had a surplus budget to work with. Antar, should he win, would inherit a city that's in some serious debt. And we don't even know to what extent the debt actually is, right? So that shows you some degree of the trouble that we're in. And then there's some very concrete plans on our enemies to gentrify the city very quickly, through a couple of initiatives, this One Lake initiative, the expansion and building out of this medical corridor, and them building a new football stadium that they're trying to execute in the course of the next like year, year and a half. So these are all some things that Chokwe Antar is going to have to contend with. The city's in debt, gentrification is being planned, orchestrated, and executed very quickly. And then we have looming threats of the privatization of our water system, the loss of our school system to a state takeover. So it's a different time. And we are starting off much more on the defensive this go around than last time around. So there's some house kind of cleaning that's going to have to get done and securing some of the operations of the city and warding off those threats. But we're not without a forward position. And so the basic thing that we are really going to be putting forth and fighting for is what we call kind of our transition city model, right? And that is changing the policies and procedures and all the rules around the procurement to make sure that the city from above supports the efforts at building cooperatives and building other types of solidarity economic institutions from below and kind of clearing the way in the political space to make that happen. We need the city in Antar to follow through on the commitment to making Jackson a sustainable city and making real commitments towards becoming zero waste, zero emissions. And that will go a long way towards not only creating a cleaner and better environment, but actually creating some job for the community around recycling, around better, more efficient, more comprehensive waste management, which reinforces and builds out the cooperative economic component. Another component that we're asking them to really commit to and build out is a forward position around what we're calling the Fab City, which is introducing technology on a comprehensive way in the community that we've talked about here before on these airwaves around the fabrication of digital production and really scaling that up. We're just getting started on our own autonomous basis, but there are ways in which we want to make that really ubiquitous or commonplace throughout the community, putting in all of the primary schools, the libraries, having it so that our people in our community have some basic access and control of the means of production right at their immediate fingertips, basically, and just have to work out the democratic process of how do people use the equipment, have access to it so they can meet their own needs over a gradual period of time. And then the final component is following through the timeless commitment around the Malcolm X grassroots movement around human rights and making Jackson a human rights city. And that starts with, you know, making sure that the charter that we've been developing gets instituted immediately. And that is backed up by the Human Rights Commission, which has some real teeth, starting with the police department is one example, to hire, fire, and prosecute when and where necessary, and they have that something that is democratic control. Members of those commission be elected and not appointed from the community so that you kind of eliminate the police union and the police themselves having some say-so. Just having that is not a ultimate protection. You're still going to have to fight because those institutions can be co-opted, as we know. But these are the basic kind of forward position pieces that we expect the Lumumba administration to kind of come up with that's going to, I think, set the foundation for us to really build out some more possibility for us to build a more self-reliant, self-determined municipality that can be used as a solid foundation for Black and Left strength within this empire. So that's what we envision. That's what we're planning for. But it's a serious struggle ahead facing all of those contradictions that I mentioned at the top of this question.
The concentrated presence of the Malcolm X grassroots movement has made Jackson a kind of a mecca for some Black activists, even in the years when you were out of power. What kind of help have you gotten from outside, from the rest of the Black activist community around the country?
We've gotten a good amount of help. I would credit you all's commentary as a help, education. I think keeping people on their toes, keeping folks mindful of the treacherous history of Black left forces getting into electoral politics and losing their way or compromising to no end. I think that's a long-term benefit, help, and strength that can't be or shouldn't be underestimated. But, you know, we've had forces from Black Workers for Justice and the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, Black is Back Coalition, All African People's Revolutionary Party and African People's Socialist Party. Folks in our broad kind of family have helped out. Folks from the Nation of Islam locally and nationally have come helped out. We've gotten good amount of support from trade unions, particularly some of the Black caucuses, in particular from the trade union, from CWA, and it's been a real strong anchor of support. Teamsters Black Caucus has been a good anchor of support. I know some of the Black longshoremen from out of Oakland and the Bay Area in particular have been a strong support, sent in some resources. So folks have been supportive from within the Black left. More of your white left institutions have kind of came on board somewhat late, just go around. But, you know, after the primary, there's been a fair amount of ink that has been kind of spilled in terms of folks pointing towards Antar and the victory that I think has been helpful, particularly going into the primary. So folks have been paying some attention. I don't think it's been initially, it wasn't to the same degree on the front end as it was for Chokwe. And that was a concern of ours and the criticism we had of some folks who were kind of feeling like fair weather friends. But towards the end, folks turned out. I mean, I think particularly the last 2 weeks, a good number of left forces, I think, really turned out. But oftentimes, that just looks like one person coming out for 3 or 4 days. But that helps. You know, that's a tremendous help. We know, you know, all of our organizations are strapped for resources, strapped for capacity. So just being able to send one person down for a weekend, we don't take that as a small commitment, a small insignificant gesture of solidarity, particularly when people paying their own dimes, because our campaign is not one which has a paid staff. It didn't when Chokwe was running. It hasn't been with Chokwe Antar running. One thing that should be noted, Chokwe Antar got outspent by both of the folks who played second and third. They raised and spent more than each of them, spent more than double of what we raised and spent. Even though you would think it would be reversed, given what the polls clearly had indicated over a year ago and how well we had placed in the 2014 special election. But it just shows you where the forces of capital were placing their bets, and it was against us. So I think that's a demonstration of some of the grassroots work that we've been trying to plug away at here in Jackson for quite some time, and it is a demonstration of a broad level of support that we have. But we anticipate that there's going to be a lot of fanfare come June 6th and beyond, which we welcome. We're going to need ongoing, I think, exposure and support going forward, I think, to really be able to hold some of our enemies at bay and to beat the isolation and fragmentation that they're going to definitely try to force down our throats.
Well, if you prevail in June, you might cement Jackson's reputation as a mecca that is a kind of political counterpoint to the bling and money of Atlanta. Jackson as a mecca for advanced politics of the black kind.
Well, we hope so. We hope so. We plan so. We put in our work to do so. We hope to try to create enough of a guide and a practice that others can pick up, emulate, take forward, and move even further down the line and further up the field than we do. Because this is not going to survive and be all it could be in isolation. We need some other cities, some other counties to move and develop and take this up from a point of strength. Because just being, you know, a small, isolated municipality trying to rumble with these reactionary forces, that can only go so far. So the point is to have others take the lessons that we've kind of accumulated and move forward, because we don't want to be in isolation. We can't exist and thrive in isolation. And we got to create some new models contrary to what has happened over the last 40, 50 years in Atlanta. I think we've seen where that road and that path leads, and we're trying to blaze a new one, learning from that accumulation of mistakes so we can do right by our people and right for the cause of justice.
That was Kelly Acuno speaking from Jackson, Mississippi. Activist and author David Swanson, publisher of the influential website War is a Crime, recently returned from a trip to Russia. Since many Americans, especially Democrats, have been tripping out on Russia, we thought we'd ask Swanson what he discovered on his trip.
I wanted to see what Russians thought about foreign policy, about the United States, about all the scandals in Washington, D.C. that mention Russia all the time, but hardly ever have any evidence of anything in them. You know, I wanted to get Russian perspectives, and I wanted to make friends with Russians and tell them there are people in the United States who don't mean you harm. And I wanted to come back to the United States and say, hey, I met Russians and they're great people and they don't mean you harm. So that's what I've been doing.
How do Russians react to the kind of press that they've been getting in the United States? Certainly, they're aware that Russians have been demonized in this country for a very long time.
They are, and they see everything through that perspective, but they still largely distinguish the U.S. public and U.S. culture from the U.S. government, and they love Americans for the most part, and they try to speak English, and they've got their signs in Russian and English, and they're very friendly and incredibly forgiving, but they are far more aware of history as it relates to Russia, of the ending of the Cold War, of the dismantling of the Soviet Union, of the attempts at disarmament and peace, that Russia asking to join NATO, Russia asking first to join the EU, being told in both cases to go to hell, Russia trying to disarm and cooperate and be friends with the West, and being shunned and being propped up as an eternal enemy for weapons profits, and having NATO expand to its border despite the promise not to, and missile bases being put in Romania and Poland, and threats and lies. They see all this as part of an anti-Russian agenda, And they see opposition to Trump in the United States as all coming out of an anti-Russian agenda. They have no idea whatsoever that people might dislike Trump for some other reasons, and that partisan opposition to Trump might feed into opposition to Russia. I think the reality goes both ways, but they only see the one. And they have, for the most part, I mean, ordinary Russians, no idea what stories the United States has been told about Ukraine and a Russian invasion of Crimea and Ukraine and Russia shooting down an airplane and so forth. They can't fathom. From their point of view, Ukraine and Belarus or White Russia and Russia are one country, and they have the same language and they have the same religion, you know, the majority of the people. And when Khrushchev gave Crimea to Ukraine, he was giving it from the Soviet Union to the Soviet Union. It wasn't even noticed as a thing. You know, it was no big deal. And when the people of Crimea voted overwhelmingly and without any military intimidation whatsoever to rejoin Russia, that was understood as a democratic decision that they had a right to make, and as a militarily defensive advantage for Russia, which, unlike the United States, does not have troops in 175 countries around the world. It has about two foreign military bases, one of them no longer foreign, in Crimea. And if the Russian government is going to think in terms of military defense, just like every other government on Earth almost, it's going to want to have a navy and to have its ships, you know, actually near some water. So it sees its actions as defensive, and it sees what the United States did to it when the Soviet Union shut down and wanted to be friends as incredibly cruel. You know, rather than a Marshall Plan or something better than a Marshall Plan, it was salt in the wound, insults, fueling corruption. And they went through something far worse than the Great Depression and three or four times as long as the Great Depression. And the United States just doesn't care. So they increasingly dislike the U.S. government, and yet they put this desperate hope in Donald Trump.
Hillary Clinton and others wanted to establish a no-fly zone over Syria, but with the intervention of the Russians and the Russian Air Force, that was no longer possible. Last week's attack on a Syrian column on the ground in Syria seems to be an effort by the United States to establish a no-go kind of zone on the ground.
Indeed. And people in Russia disliked Hillary Clinton intensely and Barack Obama intensely. And the sanctions that were put on Russia are hated and have unified people behind Vladimir Putin. We had prominent people who met with us say, "I will go back to criticizing Putin when the sanctions end. Meanwhile, I'm going to unite behind him." And this is why state media, which is as persuasive as corporate media in the United States, is part of it. But people are united behind Vladimir Putin for resisting the United States and its militarism, including in Syria. And a lot of people over there believe that if Hillary Clinton were president, there would be, as she openly threatened, massively increased war in Syria, likely war between the United States and Russia in Syria, if not elsewhere. And so they have this strong preference for Donald Trump and actually view Donald Trump as something of a maybe an improvement on Ronald Reagan, somebody you can talk to, maybe get somewhere and make peace. And, you know, and I'm in the position of having to defend the relative intellectual abilities of Ronald Reagan, of all people. But, you know, I think everyone wants to have hope. And if there's no place to put hope, you put it in the most plausible place. And sadly, that's Trump at the moment for Russians.
The Russians must be mystified to think that Americans believe that their leader, Putin, could actually work such effective wonders with the U.S. electoral system.
Yes, they find it laughable, as well as insulting, but they find it laughable. And those who are at all informed find it intensely hypocritical. You know, the United States openly brags about having imposed, you know, the Donald Trump of Russia, Boris Yeltsin, on the Russians and interferes with elections all over the world. You have Barack Obama with a video campaign ad for a French candidate while Samantha Power is accusing Vladimir Putin of trying to influence the French election. This sort of hypocrisy really grates on the Russians. Their primary demand, you know, is not for wealth, it's not for global dominance, it's for respect, it's for being treated like an equal partner in the world rather than a child. And when the United States just fills the world's airwaves with these stories without any evidence about evil Russian plots to take over a foreign election, it does make for great humor, but a lot of them take it seriously as well.
Yes, there are no Russians openly handing out money to dissident groups in the United States. I think you and I would know about it if there were. And yet, not just the United States, but lots of Western countries have operatives in Russia handing out cash and subsidizing different organizations.
Well, I should note that a couple years ago, I blogged about the fact a Russia member of the Russian military tried to give me money to start publishing Russian articles under my name, and I not only refused, but went public with it and denounced it. And Russia has Russian media in the form of Sputnik and RT in the United States, but it does not begin to compare remotely with what the United States does shamelessly in Russia, in Ukraine, around the world, not just seeking to influence elections with campaign ads or with handing out of cash, but overthrowing governments, facilitating coups. I mean, what was done in Ukraine was the facilitation of a violent coup. And you have people in Washington openly talking about wanting to overthrow the Russian government, part of the thinking behind the sanctions, which, of course, are having the exact opposite effect. They're strengthening the current Russian government. But there's just no comparison between what the United States does in terms of propaganda and election influence and militarism to what Russia or anyone else does. And most of the world, not just Russia, finds that idea laughable.
That was David Swanson speaking from Washington. Black people in the South American nation of Colombia are on a general strike in the port city of Buenaventura. Charo Mina Rojas is an activist with Black Community Process, part of a broad spectrum of Afro-Colombian organizations that are protesting racism and poverty in the region.
Buenaventura is the main port in Colombia that moves over $7 billion yearly and has this tremendous economic interest focused on the so-called development of the city. And meanwhile, the population, mostly Black, is over 500,000 people, don't have water. They have water cuts over 150 days per year. Most of the time, they don't have water. They don't have access to health. The teachers haven't been paid in many months. The quality of education is very low. In consequence, the violence in the neighborhoods is excruciating. Unemployment is over 60%. This is a town that lives on 80% of their people is under poverty. So there are environmental issues, there are economic issues, there is a humanitarian crisis, as they put it. So they decide, after trying to call the attention of the national government, to take the streets and close the main roads that bring access to merchandise and the goods and all the things that this port moves from the most parts of the world through Colombia down to Latin America. So people have decided that they will continue on the streets and on strike indefinitely until they reach agreements, very detailed demands that they have with the national government.
What organizations are involved in calling this strike in Colombia's most important, mostly Black city?
Well, there is over 80 organizations, several unions, worker unions from the port, fishing, from health, from education, from workers of the port, from the fishermen. All those are unions that are involved in the strike. The Black Communities Process, PCN, which is the organization I'm part of, is also involved and is part of the leadership of the group. The pastoral, which is linked to the Catholic Church, but is heavily involved in the social issues of Buenaventura, very outspoken and active, is involved. Women's organizations, youth organizations, cultural organizations, pretty much all the organizations and all the sectors organized in Buenaventura are involved in this strike.
And how have the Colombian authorities responded to this broad resistance?
The response has been violence. We have on Friday the 19th, the second day of the strike, a very vicious attack by the riot police. The police that confronts riots is called SMAD. And they attack the different points that people have taken to control the path of trucks and transportation. Because this is a community mobilization, there were elders, they were youth, they were kids, they were pregnant women, so they attack everybody. We have several kids very affected by the gases they throw on people, and some elders, some of them needed to be hospitalized. We have some people injured because they shot rubber bullets to people. And it was a complete chaos. It was like Buenaventura was under war. It was a heavy mobilization of military and police that nevertheless wasn't able to control some of the riots and some of the forces that were trying to disturb the peaceful mobilization and were attacking some of the stores and taking stuff from stores. This is people, and it's important to mention it because media focus on that part and doesn't focus on the attacks of the peaceful civilians, is that we have to understand that Buenaventura has been taken in control by paramilitary forces, and we understand that these forces wanted to discredit the civil strike, and is why they get violent and took the opportunity to destroy many places in the city, where the people from the Paro Civico was actually trying to prevent that happen. But the attack was vicious. It had continued up to today, but the strike continues because people has decided to systematic changes in Buenaventura.
What most people know about Colombia is that there's a peace process underway between the government and guerrilla groups. But Black and indigenous Colombians feel that this process ignores their interests.
Right, absolutely. And it is important to mention and remind people that all the eyes of the world are put on Colombia and its peace process, because it's supposed to be a reference. It's the most comprehensive agreement that has happened. And we're supposed to be a reference for the world in terms of peace. But ironic to see how the response of the government is for situations that are simply the demands of people to respect their rights. People in Buenaventura are simply demanding the respect of their rights, basic rights, fundamental rights. And the response is this violence. We don't see opportunities for real peace in Colombia if Black people continued under these racist attacks and treatment by the national government.
Black Colombians are guaranteed certain rights as a group, territorial rights, economic rights. Has the government been respecting those rights in this period that's supposed to be one of national reconciliation?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, it has been totally ignored. The government is passing fast-track special authority to the president to sign laws if the Congress don't approve them or there is not enough time to discuss them. It's passing via fast-track several laws and regulations that have enormous impact in the rights that we have gained through struggles through decades. And although the agreement, the peace agreement, and the ethnic chapter within the peace agreement that we made to put in there by forcing and pressuring the government, says that under no circumstances the rights of Afro-descendant and ethnic people could be impacted, then all these laws are doing exactly that, impacting our rights. And on top of that, there are no prior consultation and consent of Black people about the decisions that have been taken already or are about to be taken. And these situations like Buenaventura are key points. They have key elements that are part of what supposedly the peace agreement is reaching for, which is social, racial, economic, environmental, cultural justice. So nothing of this is going to happen in our territories with our people because we are completely ignored and better attacked by the government.
What demands are being put forth by your organization and by the other resistance groups in the region?
One of the main basic demands is that the president declared that Buenaventura is under humanitarian, environmental, economic, and social crisis. This is very important because this gives a different level of attention to the situation in Buenaventura. It's an open door for the other set of agreements, the points that they want to discuss. Some have to do with resolving the issues that has water in Buenaventura. I can put this at the level of Detroit, for people in the United States that know the situation in Detroit, where people don't have water, where people have been months and months without water. This is the situation of the main port in Colombia. People don't have water, don't have basic needs like sewer system, this basic infrastructure that ensure even health for people. The other key element is the health, because they don't have proper hospitals to attend the situation, the health situation in Buenaventura. They have a small hospital that doesn't have enough personal staff. And Buenaventura is an area that receives most of the people from the Pacific coast as the initial part where people get for medical attention. So they need the improvement of this service, education. Teachers need to be paid so people can reach a better quality of education. And security. Security is another issue. As I have mentioned, Buenaventura has been under control of paramilitary forces and narcotraffic forces linked all together and sometimes in collusion with the local authorities. And people is looking for investigations that dismantle these paramilitary forces and bring peace, real peace and security to the town.
That was Charo Mina Rojas in Colombia, South America. Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, are demanding release of documents related to the conduct of a former prosecutor and judge who was instrumental in getting Mumia sentenced to death in 1982 in the killing of a Philadelphia cop. That sentence was later reduced to life in prison. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Gwendolyn Dubrow, an activist with the campaign to bring Mumia home.
We are initiating a press conference Tuesday, May 30th, in Philadelphia, in front of the DA's office, demanding that they release all the documents in Mumia's case. The judge ordered, Judge Leon Tucker from the Common Pleas Court in Philadelphia, instructed the DA's office to release all documents pertaining to Ronald Castile's involvement in the prosecution of Mumia Abu-Jamal and his actions to attain a death sentence in that case. This is the reason why we're having the press conference. We're also going to be going to the different media outlets there as well.
And can you just expand a bit on why it is that the organizations working to free Mumia have decided on this rally? What are the concerns with respect to the DA's office and their releasing the files?
Well, our first and immediate concern is that the DA, which is currently embroiled in a corruption scandal with the leading DA, Seth Williams, might in a corruption scandal and court hearing. His hearing is going to be in June. We're concerned, our primary concern is that they're going to ignore the court order by Judge Tucker. And we feel it's pertinent that we mobilize and have a press conference and initiate a call-in to the DA's office demanding that they release all the documents in regards to Mumia's case, his 1982 trial, and Castile's involvement in securing the immoral and wrongful death sentence in Mumia's case. Mumia has been in prison for 36 years. This is a man who never should have been there in the first place. Mumia is not what he is deemed to be in the media, which is a cop killer. Mumia is the furthest from that kind of a person. He's a journalist, a commentator, a human rights activist, a father and a grandfather at this point, and innocent. He didn't kill a police officer, and it's time the DA release all the documents that show the systemic corruption in Mumia's case and several other cases where people were sentenced to death row wrongfully. This case is infamous. It's an infamous case going back, like I said, 36 years, and it's time we pull a lid off the case and expose this systemic corruption and bias and prosecutorial misconduct and DA misconduct in this case, and also the police frame-up of Mumia, simply because he was a Black Panther and an outspoken critic of the police department's actions in Philadelphia. The case has been a frame-up from the very get-go, and Castile has his hands all mired in it, and the DA at this point should turn over all documents pertaining to Mumia's frame-up, because it was a frame-up from the get-go, and Castile made sure that Mumia would be found guilty and sentenced to death row. So what we're calling for at the press conference are three things: the release of all documents containing Castile's involvement, and more broadly, all of the documents pertaining to the 1982 trial in which Mumia was found guilty. We're also demanding that the media pay attention to this case because it's world-renowned, and Mumia is a Philadelphian. He was born and raised in Philadelphia, and the public has the wrong idea of what went on about this case, and they need to be informed as to what's going on and why it's very crucial that the media pays attention and focuses on this case and other cases. There's 16 other cases that Ronald Castile had a personal involvement in securing death sentences. I mean, he actually brags about sending 42 people to death row while he was the DA. And the other thing we're asking is for the public to get involved. That's the third thing. To call the DA's office and demand that the documents be released. We need full disclosure on this case and the 16 other cases in which the former DA and former Pennsylvania Supreme Court Justice had a personal involvement in those cases as well.
So May 30th is the court-appointed deadline by which the Philadelphia DA's office must turn over all of the files that show Ronald Castile's involvement in Mumia's case. How do these documents factor in to the larger struggle of getting Mumia out of prison?
We learned several years ago, more than 10 years ago, I guess it's probably maybe 20 years now, that the DA, he was a supervising DA when Mumia was found guilty and sentenced to death row, and he had a personal involvement in teaching DAs how to keep Black people off of the jury so they attain convictions and not worry about, is this person actually really guilty? I mean, is that what it's about? Now, is that what the DA's office, they're just worried about attaining convictions, never mind whether that person is actually guilty? We also want to find out what his role was in advising how to attain a conviction in Mumia's case. And it's not only Mumia's case. The reason why we're getting this far is because the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in June of 2016 that a judge cannot sit on an appeals case when he had personal involvement in an earlier prosecution, and that is the Terrence Williams versus Pennsylvania case.
Right. So how would that overturning of Mumia's conviction play out based on these Ronald Castile files?
Assuming that the documents get released and we find what we already know, what's in the file, that Castile did have a personal involvement in securing Mumia's conviction and death sentence, then we would wait for Judge Tucker's ruling to go ahead with the case, go ahead with the PCR, a hearing, and opening up a windfall, and Mumia could then appeal his conviction. Then he can have a whole new trial, possibly. This is monumental. And then the next thing that would have to happen is Judge Tucker would have to rule that the case should go on and Mumia should be allowed to file an appeal for the overturning of the conviction. It's a long process, but a necessary process, because Judge Castile, he's not a judge now, he was forced into retirement. But when you stack the deck against a defendant to make sure he stays in prison, that's why Mumia is where he's at, because his appeals were always turned down simply because of the politics of the case and the people that were able to rise politically because of his case and the Move 9 case, and simply being concerned about convictions rather than being concerned about justice.
Right. So in a new political atmosphere, perhaps being able to retry this case around Mumia would reap different results.
Correct. And that's what we're hoping for. I mean, we also had a victory in getting Mumia the treatment that he needs for his active hepatitis C, in which he almost went into a coma because they didn't even know, they never informed him that he had onset diabetes brought on by hepatitis C. In January, Judge Mariani ordered that Mumia should get the hepatitis C treatment. The DOC fought it, they lost, and now Mumia is getting it. And also, the governor said, I think it was a week ago, that they're now going to treat people with hepatitis C who have Medicaid. So winning Mumia's case, getting the case files opened up and discovery is very important, because it would shed light on what the DA knew initially in Mumia's case and some of the other cases in which people were convicted and sentenced to death wrongfully, including Terrence Williams.
Do you recall, over the years struggling for Mumia's freedom, any moments like this one that allowed for such a real possibility of Mumia actually being released?
Only other time I could think of where I was excited about something was when he was removed from death row. That was a monumental moment, because that meant that the DA, they had given up, because they didn't want that information revealed. They could have retried it and went into court to resecure a death sentence, but they realized that they didn't want to go any further. But this new ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled that a former judge shouldn't be sitting on an appeals case in which he had a prior involvement in attaining the prosecution, they said that is unconstitutional. Well, there are at least over 20 violations in Mumia's case. And it's not only him. It's just rampant corruption in the Philadelphia DA's office. All they're concerned about is convictions, and they're not really concerned about attaining justice. That's wrong. Mumia should be out. Terrence Williams should likely be out. He's still on death row. He's at SCI Green. Still on death row, appealing his conviction.
And you're calling for people to call and write around this question of releasing Ronald Castile's files. Do you have that information to share with the listeners?
Yes. Please call the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office at 215-686-8000. If you don't speak to someone, leave a message. demanding, leaving them with your name, demanding that the files in Mumia Abu-Jamal's case be turned over to Mumia's lawyers immediately, forthwith. Do not appeal the case. Do not appeal Judge Tucker's decision. We need those files released so our lawyers, Mumia's lawyers, can get a look at them and we can go on from there and attain real justice. That's what we need. And we need people to call ASAP, starting now. And the number again, Philadelphia DA's office is 1-215-686-8000. His freedom is a fight for all. All those wrongfully incarcerated and getting a raw deal by this system.
That was Gwendolyn Dubrow of the campaign to bring Mumia home. Mumia is a regular commentator for Prison Radio. In his latest essay, Abu-Jamal says he hears the sound of something collapsing, not just in Washington, but throughout the U.S. empire.
The fall. It has been exceedingly difficult to write about the Trump presidency, seemingly crumbling before our eyes. In part, that's because of the sheer pace of new revelations, scandals superseded by new scandals, the inane utterances and tweets of the president, a daily cascade of craziness. Part of this is the new media, which rushes at us on a 24-hour clock with no sense of cessation. Part of it is Trump's sheer obsession with social media and his unique ability to undermine his own spokespersons with a tweet. We are in the midst of the latest reality show, The Trump Show, featuring Donald J. Trump, a manic superstar who hasn't decided whether to host a comedy or a tragedy, but has seemingly settled for farce. One recent New York Times editorial mused about being a nation ruled by a child, a petulant, ill-mannered, tantrum-prone 6-year-old playing emperor of the world. In the space of a quarter of a year, Trump has led his administration into the morass of the Russia trap. His country, by the way, suffers from Trump-induced exhaustion. His party, the Trump Party, appears to be a union of maniacs. Their central program, to defend a president who seems unable or unwilling to defend himself. The corporate media, which fed from the Trump trough during the campaign, has acquired the taste for Trump flank and now competes for the biggest bombshell to bring down USS Trump. Not since Watergate have we seen such a fever fury for the hide of a president. When I was a young college student at Goddard in Vermont, I bought a copy of the New York Times in the local general store. There was a very tiny article on the first page on the failed burglary at the Watergate Hotel. Who knew that such a small thing would topple a president? It now looks quaint compared to the things we see before us now. This is bigger, bolder, uglier, more crass. This smells of corruption, of capitalist greed and excess, and of imperial arrogance on a grand global scale. This feels like the beginning of the end.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.